I'm Morris Wee. I'm a parish pastor in Northfield, Minnesota. And I used to teach literature. And so this is a perfect combination for me. I enjoy studying scripture and leading discussions of it, which I hope this will be in part. And I'm pleased to be here with you. This is a study of the story of Joseph, starting at chapter 37, runs right through chapter 50, through the end of Genesis. And over the course of the week, we'll be looking at different portions of this story and reading much of it aloud as a way of getting into the details of the story. We all know the outline, so we want to look a little bit more at the details this week and talk together about that. There are a couple of parish pastors often like sermon series on the seven last words or the Ten Commandments or something, in the hopes that people will come to the first few and then want to come to the rest. I hope it works that way. And of course, the downside of this is if they come to the first few and they don't like them, you might not see them the rest of the week. So I hope it works the other way in your case. Today is just chapter 37, and it sets the scene for much of what happens in the chapters that follow. And the titles are on the board. I'll just mention them. The next Tuesday's session is called "The Lord Was With Him," mostly about Joseph in Egypt, in exile there, after he's been sold into slavery. Then after he becomes great in Egypt, Wednesday and Friday, we will look at the trial of the brothers, the elaborate thing that Joseph puts them through before he reveals himself to them when they come down to Egypt looking for food. The fourth day on Friday is the reconciliation of the brothers. Friday is the fourth day because Thursday, I don't do Bible study. There's a study of the texts for the coming Sunday that's led by Scott Hosrud, I believe. And then finally on Saturday, the end of Genesis, when the patriarch dies. My wife Christine looked at that and said, "That's a pretty male list of things you're doing here. This is a story of these 12 brothers and their father." And well, it's true. There are women who figure significantly in this story. The four wives of Jacob are in the background in important ways. Dinah, the one sister who's mentioned, is a significant figure earlier in Genesis. Unfortunately, she's significant because she's raped and her brothers go and kill a bunch of people as a result of it. Tamar, who it comes up in chapter 38, which strikes some people as being out of place because it interrupts the story of Joseph, but it's a very significant placement, I think, of that story of Judah, one of Joseph's brothers, and Tamar, because Judah figures in significant ways in the Joseph story too, and we'll talk about that later. Anyway, for today, chapter 37, the family is torn. But before I get into that, there are a couple things I want to say. First of all, please interrupt with questions anytime you want or with your own comments or additions. I'd like this to be as much a discussion as it can be, and I hope to give us time to discuss on and off during the week. I want to say at the outset, we always have to ask, might we be wrong? What we'll ask that about, I'm not sure, but we'll see. Is there anybody who is having trouble hearing me and would like some kind of sound enhancement, such as raising my voice or getting some mechanical aid from the office? They have them. If you can't hear well, they have some kind of what we used to call hearing aids, and that is now called sound enhancement. So if you do need that, we can get a hold of something. There is a class project, and the class project is to, this is optional, but over the course of the week, I would like those of you who are so inclined to work on lyrics to a hymn. This hymn sort of had its genesis on the boat day before yesterday when I was visiting with some people about the good old days in the church. And suddenly this topic, this hymn title, How Great It Was, popped into somebody's mind. And so I jotted down a sort of hypothetical starting verse here, and I don't like it very much, so I need some help. So I'm going to sing this for you just to give you the idea, and it may generate some thoughts and some creativity, I hope, in you. And then, just to give you an idea of what I mean. When I think back to how we used to do things, it makes me mad that church should ever change. The younger crowd insists on doing new things. New tunes, new words, new... I can't remember what I had in here. And everything is strange. The good old days, the way things used to be. How great it was, how great it was, when clergymen addressed God, thou, and thee. How great it was, how great it was. All right, that gives you the idea. even the chorus there, I'm a little uncertain about. I think I might want to go with how great thou wert. But then we have to say, you good old days, how great thou wert. So I'm trying to decide on that, and if you come up with anything to help with that, I'd appreciate it. And the subject matter for stanzas, you know, you can imagine might be translations of scripture, might be one. The LBW and other possible worship books might be another. Holy Communion. How we do it, how often, who gets to come, so on, you know, might be an issue. The role of women as clergy, or for that matter, as ushers, you know, those kinds of things. So anyway, if this gets your juices going, by all means, write up some verses, and by the end of the week, I'll have a panel of judges who are tasteful and astute, and we'll choose what works the best, and we'll come up with something. And I was told by the people at the first Bible study that this had to be performed at dinner on Saturday. I don't know what that means, what it is about dinner on Saturday, but sometime maybe it'll happen. Okay. Just a word about how I like to read Scripture, what I think about Scripture. I'd like us to think about it as a living word. Something that may actually move us, get into our life, and bother us, or teach us, or change us. And to do that, it can't be dead. It's got to be something that's alive. I was struck in the Emily Dickinson presentation that some of you may have seen Saturday night by this little poem of hers that I've always liked. That I've written on the board. A word is dead when it is said, some say. I say it just begins to live that day. This is about what we mean by living word. Whether words, once they're spoken, are over and done with, or once they're written down, are kind of flat on the page, or whether they really have a life that then works on people and works on us. And I think it's always possible to pick up a book and regard it as something static, something kind of objectively there. It's about something that happened 3,000 years ago, or it's about what somebody 2,000 years ago thought about what happened 3,000 years ago. And it's something we can study like mad to learn everything that it meant, but it doesn't move us. I think that often happens when we study the Bible, and because it's our scripture, you know, I guess I wouldn't want to say that any writing is dead. And that every writing has the possibility for coming to life as we work on it. But there's something about sacred scripture that adds to that, a sense of the profundity of what it is that comes to life in us when we read it. But I would like us to think about the scripture as we hear it and we read it this week as something that is alive, that the experience of it is not in the book and it's not in us, but it is somewhere in between in our interaction with it. The theme for this summer is listen to the sacred, which is a great theme if you're a Bible study leader. You know, it just seems perfect. And of course, when you come to Holden, you think first about the mountains and the natural environment as also something sacred that speaks to us. When I read Scott Hosserud's introductory remarks about this that came to us back home, I was pleased that he emphasized listening to one another, to other people, and the sacred in them as probably the central thing he mentioned. Also talking about other ways we listen for the sacred and to the sacred. Of course, reading scripture is another of those. But I want to say that when we read scripture, one of the most important things we do is listen to one another's reactions to it and speak with one another, have a conversation about scripture. It isn't something that is some esoteric writing that can only be understood by scholars who come before you and speak to you and tell you what it all means, which is somehow how pastors are regarded or theologians and somehow how people view the Bible with some kind of fear that if they pick it up and read it, they're not going to get it. I think that it's quite possible to get the Bible, to pick it up and read it yourself and know that it's speaking to you. And by being in conversation with other people who are doing that, to have it further enriched. And that we don't need to wait for the scholars and the people who know Hebrew to be able to help us with this. They will help us with it. But we can get started and we can do wonderful things with it ourselves, just working with an English text and responding to it according to our experience, which is all we got to go with. So, and trusting that God is working in that process, the process of the conversation we have. So when we read this familiar story today, as we're about to, as eight of you are about to read for us, and you read along, I want you to listen, assuming that you're going to learn something new about it, and certain details I'd like you to attend to. One is the words that describe family relationships. Brothers, father, my brother, flesh and blood. You know, those kinds of words. There are quite a few of them in this chapter, and they're quite revealing. What else did I want you to make sure to think about in here? The emotions of the people and the family dynamics that you pick up in this story. So let's start out by hearing the story, Genesis 37, the whole chapter, read by our volunteers, and then we'll look at it in detail, and I'll encourage your reactions to it. Our first narrator?
Right here.
Okay.
You want me to skip from verse 3 down to 11?
No, that is somebody else is going to pick up at 3.
Okay.
Yeah.
Jacob dwelt in the land of his father's sojournings in the land of Canaan. This is the history of the family of Jacob.
Go ahead. Read the next half of that verse.
Joseph, being 17 years old, was shepherding the flock with his brothers. He was a lad of the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah, his father's wives, and Joseph brought an ill report of them to their father.
Now Israel loved Joseph more than any other of his children because he was and he made him a long robe with sleeves. But when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all the his brothers, they hated him, and they could not speak peaceably to him. Now Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they only hated him the more. He said to them, "Hear this dream which I have dreamed.
Oh, yeah.
Did my hair
Joseph.
Hear this dream which I have dreamed. Behold, we were binding sheaves in the field, and lo, my sheaf arose and stood upright. And behold, your sheaves gathered round it and bowed down to my sheaf.
His brother said to him, Are you indeed to reign over us? Or are you indeed to have dominion over us? So they hated him yet more for his dreams and for his words.
Okay. Back to the narrator.
Then he dreamed another dream and told it to his brothers and said,
Behold, I have dreamed another dream, and behold, the sun, the moon, and 11 stars were bowing down to me.
But when he told it to his father and to his brothers, his father rebuked him and said to him,
What is this dream that you have dreamed? Shall I and your mother and your brothers indeed come to bow ourselves to the ground before you?
And his brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept saying in mind.
Now his brothers went to pasture their father's flock near Shechem. And Israel said to Joseph,
Are not your brothers pasturing the flock at Shechem? Come, I will send you to them.
And he said to them,
Here I am.
So he said to him,
Go now, see if it is well with your brothers, and with the whoops.
We reversed something there, but this is the father speaking now.
Yeah, fathers.
Go now, see if it is well with your brothers and with the flock, and bring me word again.
So he sent him from the valley of Hebron, and he came to Shechem. And a man found him wandering in the fields, and the man asked him,
What are you seeking? I am seeking my brothers,
he said.
Tell me, I pray you, where are they pasturing the flock?
And the man said,
They've gone away, for I heard them say, Let us go to Dothan.
So Joseph went after his brothers and found them in Dothan. They saw him afar off, and before he came near to them, they conspired against him to kill him. And they said to one another,
Here comes this dreamer. Come, now let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits. Then we shall say that a wild beast has devoured him, and we shall see what shall become of his dreams.
But when Reuben heard it, he delivered him out of their hands, saying,
Let us not take his life.
And Reuben said to them,
Shed no blood. Cast him into this pit here in the wilderness, but lay no hand upon him.
That he might rescue him out of their hand to restore him to his father. So when Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped him of his robe, the long robe with the sleeves that he wore, and they took him and cast him into the pit. The pit was empty, and there was no water in it. Then they sat down to eat, and looking up, they saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead, with their camels bearing gum, balm, and myrrh on their way to carry it down to Egypt. Then Judah said to his brothers,
What profit is it if we slay our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites. And let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother, our own flesh.
And his brothers heeded him. And the Midianite traders passed by, and they drew Joseph up and lifted him out of the pit, and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. And they took Joseph to Egypt. When Reuben returned to the pit and saw that Joseph was not in the pit, he rent his clothes and returned to his brothers and said,
The lad is gone. And I, where shall I go?
Then they took Joseph's robe and killed a goat and dipped the robe in the blood. And they sent the long robe with sleeves and brought it to their father and said,
The brothers.
Oh, this we have found. See now whether it is your son's robe or not.
And he recognized it and said,
It is my son's robe. A wild beast has devoured him. Joseph is without doubt torn to pieces.
Then Jacob rent his garments and put a sackcloth upon his loins and mourned for his son many days. All his sons and all his daughters rose up to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted and said,
No, I shall go down to Sheol to my son, mourning.
Thus his father wept for him.
Meanwhile, the Midianites had sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the guard.
All right. Thank you. The story this far, this portion of the story, it seems to me, has three parts that we could identify easily. There's, after the opening sentence setting it up, there's background material, the dreams, the attitude of the brothers toward Joseph. Then there's the central event. Joseph goes out to the brothers, they conspire to kill him, they sell him to the passing traders. And then there are the repercussions that start even at the end of this chapter as the responses to what they've done start coming, and one after another they rip their garments, which is where I got the title, A Family is Torn. But what I want to do is start at the beginning and look through at some details of this passage, and I'd invite you to interrupt, add your perceptions and so on, and then we'll have some time for discussing issues later. Are there any questions right off hand at the beginning here about what this meant? You know, any technical questions about what's going on? All right. Let's taking a look at the outset. The story begins, "This is the story of the family of Jacob." Now, right away, as I was reading this, I put Joseph on the headings for all these things. But the heading, it tells us this is a story of the family of Jacob. And as soon as we get into it, we realize this isn't about Joseph. This is about family dynamics. It's about a big, complex family. One father, four mothers, 12 sons, at least one daughter, a whole lot of grandchildren. It's a big, complex family, and this story is about the dynamics in that family. Yeah.
It strikes me that it also could be about organizational dynamics, like in church.
Huh. Very interesting. We got to come back to that. Let's keep that in mind. Yeah, organizational dynamics. All right. We start out with Joseph, 17 years old, and what do we hear about him? He was shepherding the flock with his brothers. This sounds fine. The family are shepherds. They're out there shepherding their flock. Semicolon. Now we get another version of what's going on. Mine says he was a helper. One of your translations said he was a lad. A helper to the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah. And who are they? I mean, who are his? Yeah. Bilhah and Zilpah, his father's wife. The sons of Bilhah and Zilpah, his father's wives. Who are those people? The sons. They're his brothers. Yeah. The first phrase called them his brothers. The second phrase calls them the sons of these two women. There's a real different feel for what kind of relationship they have. Also, he's not just shepherding with them. He's a lad helping them. He's not on the same standing with them in that phrase. The next thing we hear is Joseph brought a bad report of them to their father. What's the relationship here? He's a spy. He's out there to check on them. Or is he just a little kid running home because they said something mean to him and saying, they said a mean thing, or, you know, they're not doing it right. It's a little hard to tell, but we get a complicated set of relationships already established and different relationships here. Now, that's how the story is introduced, and all of a sudden, the narrator decides we need a little background. We got to find out more about what's behind this. So we hear that Israel or Jacob loved Joseph more than any of the other of his children because he was the son of his old age. Just thinking back about the history of Jacob, what you know about Jacob. This is the family of Jacob. What do you know? What stories do you remember about Jacob other than this one? Yeah. Yeah, falling asleep and having this angels descending and ascending, having that kind of a vision from God. Right. Other things you remember about the story of Jacob?
Wrestling with God.
Yeah. By the ford of Jabbok, wrestling with God. He's in contact with God in these various dramatic ways in various points in his life. We know that. What else do we know about Jacob?
He getting tricked out. He loved Rachel, and he Laban tricked him into marrying the older daughter.
Leah. Yeah.
And then so he had to work 7 years for Leah and then 7 more years for Rachel.
Right. Yeah. Now that's relevant. The wives here, the mothers of these 12 brothers, he worked for two of them. He worked 7 years for Rachel, and then what he got was Leah. You remember, he got tricked by Laban, his father-in-law. So then he had to work another 7 years for Rachel. She's the one that he loved. As a result, God gave children to Leah because she was unloved. Leah had the slew of children. Rachel was barren. Then finally, Rachel has a child, and who's Rachel's child?
Joseph.
Yeah. All right. That's all background here to this story. The child of his old age, not just the child of his old age, but after he'd loved this woman all these years, finally they had a child together. It's not so surprising Joseph might be a favorite of his. There's one other child of Rachel, who is Benjamin. Benjamin would be the youngest, but you might remember that Rachel died in childbirth when Benjamin was born, and that might have made Jacob's attitude toward Benjamin a little colored by that. Joseph is his favorite, but Benjamin is the other child of Rachel, and later in this story we'll see how important that is. So that's another piece of that story. What else about Jacob? The Jacob and Esau story. He tricked his brother out of his birthright. He wasn't the firstborn, but he got the rights of the firstborn by buying them, tricking him. Tricking, first of all, his brother to sell him the birthright, and tricking his father into giving him the blessing.
With the help of his mother.
With the help of his mother, thank you. Yeah. Okay, so we've got a kind of a checkered history of Jacob in the background here, involving preferences for wives, and here we see preferences for children that comes out of that. Jacob with a history of trickery, being tricked by his father-in-law, tricking other people. All right, that's the family here. I mean, that's the patriarch. And where were we? Let's see, the son of his old age. And so he had made for him a long robe with sleeves, what used to be called a coat of many colors. This is the central image of the Sunday school version of the story that we get, is this robe with long sleeves. And the significance of that is that it was a long robe. It's not a long sleeves, it's a long robe. Long robe with sleeves. The shepherds wore short robes, which wouldn't get in the way of their work, and sleeveless. They were sleeveless because it just made it easier to do the work they had to do. A long robe with sleeves was the robe of a leisure, a person at leisure, a person who was not going out shepherding. So not only was he favored in one of the ways, one of the obvious ways he was favored was his father made him this leisure robe, and that's what he's wearing when he goes out to check on his brothers. He's not going out wearing a working tunic. He's wearing the thing that reminds them that he is the favorite of the father, and that he doesn't have to do the work. He just comes and checks up on them, tells on them. All right. So there's that long robe with sleeves. And it's interesting how this is put right away. When his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him. How did they see it? They saw it in the robe. They saw the robe. The robe reminded them that, and they saw it in many other ways, no doubt, but that's how it's, the sequence here. Yes, they saw this, and they hated him. And not only did they hate him internally, but they couldn't speak peaceably with him. Their conversations were unpleasant that they had with him. They couldn't keep it inside. Now we get further flat. That's some background. Now we get the next background, and it's the dreams. We know about the dreams. What's wrong with the picture in the dream, the first dream that Joseph has here? Starting in verse 7.
He's
the center one. Really, ever works that way in biblical stories, but that's how it's supposed to be. the youngest one here shouldn't be at the center having everybody else bow down to him. Anything else?
I think it's really funny that he told them the dream in the first place. Knowing he was just going to antagonize.
Just antagonize.
Yeah, right. They don't like him. They can't speak peaceably with him. Well, how old is Joseph, do you think?
He's 17.
He's 17 when the story starts, but this is a flashback. This is background. Once, mine says once Joseph had a dream. It's ambiguous. You can't tell, but what if he were 11 and his brothers were being kind of mean to him all the time and he had this dream? He might kind of enjoy telling him this dream. And maybe if he was 17, he might enjoy telling him this dream too. He's getting treated well by his father. He's going to do fine. He doesn't have to take this guff from these brothers who in this case, well, we don't know, all the brothers are involved in the dreams. The ones he was helping up above were the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah. Why is that relevant? He had four, there were four wives involved, Rachel and Leah we've talked about. Bilhah and Zilpah are servants. They're the servants of Rachel and Leah. No doubt their children had different standing than the children of Rachel and Leah, the wives. They're all wives, as it says here, but they had been the servants of the ones that Jacob married officially. Anyway, back to the sheaves. I think the other thing that's odd about this story is Joseph doesn't work with his brothers in the field. He's got the long sleeves, but he tells this dream about as if he's out there working with them, and then all the sheaves bow down to him. But anyway, any number of things in this story might antagonize the brothers. And it is odd that he tells them. And they hate him even more because... And notice how that's told at the beginning and the end of the dream. Verse 5, when he told it, they hated him even more. When he finishes it, so they hated him even more because of his dreams and his words. Yeah, maybe it's okay to have the dream, but don't go tell it to them. And maybe he told them several times. because what happens right away here. Verse 9, he had another dream. Now, we know they don't like him. They don't speak well to him. He tells them this dream. They hate him the more. Probably he can tell. He has another dream, identical kind of dream. And what does he do? He goes and tells them again. We can ask questions about why. And we will. Why does he do this? Is this just a sign of naivete? Is he really kind of happy to share his dreams? Somebody in the other group said, well, dreams were important. Dreams were ways you understood how God was working, in fact. And so you always told dreams. Well, maybe that's the reason. Maybe he had to, kind of, you know, it was the way they did it. But they didn't like it. They didn't say, oh, I'm glad you told us this dream. Even his father, when he told the dream, his father says, what kind of dream is this you've had? And rebukes him. Now the reactions, you notice in verse 11, they're different. Their brothers were jealous. The father kept the matter in mind, my translation says. But he rebuked him for telling the dream. So Joseph may not have been using good judgment in dragging these dreams out, though they were dreams from God and they were prophetic dreams, as we find out later on. It didn't help the family relations much. But when his father heard them, though he was his favorite, he rebukes him. He kept the matter in mind. And when I hear that, I just think of Mary pondering these things in her heart. There's something peculiar or special happening here. And the people who are close, the parents, try to figure it out. They don't know. They don't know what it is. So he is sent out to the brothers quite a distance at Shechem, quite a distance to the north. And he's willing to go. Maybe he's being sent as he was out to, in verse 2 there, out to kind of check on how things are going. Maybe he might bring back a bad report if he doesn't like it or if he's just in the mood. It's not clear just what he's supposed to do. But he goes away from home, the Valley of Hebron, up to Shechem at some distance. And when he gets there, I don't know what to make of this guy who finds him. There's a man there who finds him. What I notice about that passage is that he's wandering in the fields. Mm-hmm. He's a young boy. He's out there looking for his brothers. He's kind of lost. He doesn't know what to do, but this man happens there, and this happens all the time to these scriptural stories. God sends somebody to help out. Maybe this is the messenger of God, but at any rate, he finds his brothers through the help of this man up at Dothan, further from home, out of the home territory even further. And maybe that just makes it an easier place for the brothers to think of doing evil to him. It's not the family lands at all.
Why did they call Jacob Israel and back and forth like that?
I don't know. But he has been named Israel. You remember when he wrestled with the angel, which is previous to this. The angel said, no longer will you be called Jacob, but Israel. So he's given the name Israel, and of course, he's the father of the 12 tribes, and you know, you can use those historical ways of talking about it. But I think the two names are mixed in this account because possibly it came from two different tellers of the story, and they put together good parts. And you can see that in the Midianite traders and the Ishmaelites to whom he was sold. Is it Midianites or is it Ishmaelites? It doesn't really matter to us. And it must not have mattered that much to the people who finally wrote this down, because they got it mixed up. But it's the same person, and possibly we could work on a doctoral dissertation on the shift there. There may be something significant. I haven't noticed. He goes, he finds his brothers finally at Dothan. They see him coming. They plot. And what would they call him there? Here comes this dreamer. This dreamer. That's how they think of him. And that's a word with a couple of levels of meaning, isn't it? First of all, he had these dreams. They resent it. Is it a sign of somebody who's chosen or special to God that they have dreams? Maybe it's just somebody who thinks he's important and he dreams for himself. That's another meaning of dreamer. Is it a person who doesn't work? You know, he's wandering about in the field. They're working. And he's a dreamer. He's just kind of casually wandering out there to find them. In any case, it's a word that suggests their anger, the things they don't like about Joseph. And so the response seems huge. You know, let's kill him. And we shall see what will become of his dreams. Very wonderful irony in that statement when you get to the later in the story. We shall see. They will see what will become of his dreams. That's not how they intend that. At any rate, Reuben, the eldest, the one who should take responsibility, does here. He steps in and he says, wait, let's not kill him. Shed no blood. This is before the laws of Moses. You know, we don't have all the legal, we don't have the Ten Commandments to go by here, but even in, among those people, they thought it was wrong to kill their own brother. So Reuben says, all right, let's not do that. Let's just throw him in the pit. And presumably, you know, he'll starve to death. He'll die here, but we won't have shed his blood, and they won't be guilty of that. And Reuben, of course, plans to come back, as it says, and rescue him. So that's what they do. They strip the robe. Now, they wouldn't have had to strip the robe to throw him in the pit, but they strip the robe off because that's the thing that reminds them of the things they hate about him. He's the favorite of his father. And I think there's a lot of stuff going on with the father in here. But at any rate, we'll come to that a little bit later. They strip the robe off and they throw him in the pit. And then Judah comes up with another idea down at verse 26. I'm just trying to figure out. Let's see what things I'm forgetting to say that I wanted to say here. Okay. Judah says, introduces not only just not killing him, he suggests the idea of profiting by it. Let's sell him to somebody. We'll make a little profit. And we can regard that possibly he's trying to save his life. Possibly he's just trying to figure out another way of getting rid of him. But he comes up with the same idea, but one different turn to the way Judah tells it. Reuben says, "Let us not take his life." And Judah says, "Let us not lay our hands on him, for he is our brother, our own flesh." It's the strongest statement about the relationships between them that's made in this passage so far. Our own flesh. It's a long cry from this dreamer. That seems to carry the day, that argument, and they do sell him. And they don't kill him. And they took Joseph to Egypt. And at that point, verse 29, we see the beginning of the repercussions of this action of anger. Reuben returned to the pit, saw that Joseph was not in the pit.
Interestingly, they weren't all together because he was apparently not part of the whole transaction.
Right.
He must have been somewhere else.
Yeah. There are some bits and pieces left out here and there. Where was Reuben? He comes back and he tears his clothes. He returned to his brothers and said, "The boy is gone. And I, where can I turn?" Or the lad. Have they called him the boy or the lad before? No. The narrator did at the beginning. But they plotted murder against him. And now after they've done it and sent him off, probably to his death, but to slavery anyway, suddenly he's the boy. And Reuben is ripping his clothes and wondering what he can do. He's got to go back and return to his father, knowing that Joseph was his father's favorite. So they come up with this idea. They take the robe that they had stripped off him and dip it in blood. And that robe is a symbol in this story, and dipping it in blood seems somehow to symbolize what they've done. And they bring it back, and I imagine it ripped. It doesn't say that the robe itself was ripped, but they've got to make it look like he's killed by a wild animal. Which is what Joseph immediately assumes, what Jacob immediately assumes. And then he says, Joseph is without doubt torn to pieces. We get the torn garment of Reuben, the torn robe with sleeves. Joseph is without doubt torn. Then Jacob tore his garments and put on sackcloth and mourned. And they try to console him, and he says, "No, I shall go down to Sheol, to my son, mourning. I'm going to die mourning for this boy." When I first looked at this, I thought the brothers forgot about their father. They were mad at Joseph, but they forgot how much evil they were doing to their father. But as I look at this and I see, they took that robe and they brought it back to him with the blood on it, and they throw it at him, you know, and say, "Here, we found this." I think they knew very well that they were hurting their father. And maybe they didn't know he was going to spend the rest of his life in mourning. Maybe they did. I think there's something going with between the brothers and the sons and their father too here. And it gets focused on Joseph at this point. Well, I would like to invite you to talk about this a little bit. And maybe in groups, if we've got time to do this. Yeah, let's take about 5 minutes. In groups of three, And I'd like you to discuss what in this family dynamics that we've seen in the story, what of it seems real? And is there any part of it that seems artificial, just contrived to make a point? Which would be the other side. It's a story, it's been written down. Person has been thinking about how to write it down. How real is it? I don't mean that I need you to get into your own family systems and whether they're described here, but it might provoke some thought about that. Anyway, group yourselves in threes and just take 5 minutes talking about that. Okay, I'm going to interrupt your conversations. I hate to break this up, but I'm going to ask you to come back together for a minute now. We've got about 5 minutes left, and then we can, you get started anyway. You can carry this on at coffee. Did you discover some things that we haven't talked about yet? I'd just like to hear, a response or two from your groups. Did you feel these were real family dynamics? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Pretty what uniformly. Pardon?
You want to show a
hand? Yeah. Anything new that you would share with us?
Over here we are questioning why Reuben was the one who ended up, being watched out for, because he had the most to lose, by this whole process. He was supposedly going to get all the property, and here was this young brother, who looked like he was the one who was going to now take it away from him, and why would he suddenly be the defender?
Yeah.
Or the protector, if you will.
Right.
Because he's the oldest, he feels
responsible.
That's typical behavior for the oldest.
Well, maybe.
Now Judah is the fourth born, as I was, so I just thought I'd mention that. Reuben and Judah are the two who stand out here, are singled out, and later in the story it's Judah who is the figure, and then Benjamin figures strongly later on, and the other brothers just become the brothers. But I assume Reuben because he's the eldest. I guess that's my assumption. There are other stories of Reuben. Reuben sleeps with one of his father's wives, which must be, I can't remember who it is, Bilhah or Zilpah, I suppose. And his father is angry with him, and he mentions that in the blessings later on. That's the sin that his father picks out to mention. But
it's really significant that Reuben and Judah are both Leah's sons, and you talked about the hierarchy among mm-hmm. the wives. Here are Leah's sons who would be on a par maybe with Rachel's sons. Those are mm-hmm. the two wives.
Except much older.
Yeah, older. And firstborn, but it's not Bilhah and Zilpah's sons who are the named characters in this
right.
story. Those would be the children of the slave women.
Right.
So that dynamic is entering
right.
in here too, maybe.
Right.
I just have one question. Is it Morris?
Yes.
Okay. If we assume that what is happening in the Bible is God's plan.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, he lets things happen that are human contrived and so forth. And sometimes he helps fix it, and sometimes he lets it waddle around in there. Am I clear in that the Hebrew thinking of the Bible is the why, and the Greek thinking is how?
I don't know if I'd want to put it that way. Go on. Just go on.
Well,
a bit.
I'll tell you what. That I got that, of course, out of the Bethel. That when you are studying the Bible, you want to remember that it was the Hebrew people or Hebrew writers were writing in Hebrew about the why. God's plan is. And not to get bogged down in the how.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, how the
7 days of creation or something.
Right.
Yeah, okay.
And that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And this thing, I think, I think it's really important. There's a reason we should study this, so we can apply it to today's family and try to improve these family relations. But I sometimes wonder, or I try to get the bigger picture of why God allowed these things to happen, bad things happening to good people, mm-hmm. to fulfill his plan. I mean, Joseph had, he had a plan for Joseph. Now, he could have just put him in Egypt and let, what happened to him?
Yeah.
To lead the people out. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, just, you know, pick him up and put him there. But he mm-hmm. let all these very dramatic things happen. And I'm sorry, but I'm kind of going back to last week's Bible study where, you know, they talk about Jesus and everybody gets down on the Jews, and some Christians hate Jews because he killed Jesus, and we're saying, well, that was God's plan. Maybe he planned to let him live his whole life out, but because of the radical teachings, it was bound to happen that somebody was going to do something really mm-hmm. Painful to him, and maybe it took that kind of drama to get his teachings to